Trish, you're a bit of a flibbertigibbet this morning. What's going on? You're all discombobulated.
Do you know what? I'm freezing. I'm freezing cold.
Been freezing.
Well, do you know what? It's the middle of winter and I've got every door and window open in my house.
Why?
Well,
it's my husband there. He opens every door and window every 10 minutes.
It's so not the normal of what you would expect in a hot flush. There's a really hideous smell and we can't work out what it is.
Someone buried under the boards.
Well, I think it could be. It could be. We started having dreams about people being buried under the house. I think it might be a little mouse that got lost and is now starting to,
Dear. Yeah. It's not one of your dreadful, healthy... Is it beetroot?
No, it could be one of my kale stews. Maybe it's a bit cabbagey.
Hello.
Hello. Welcome to Postcards from Midlife. I'm Lorraine Candy.
I'm Trish Halpin, and we're on a mission to help you make the most of your magnificent midlife. We'll be tackling everything from mind and body wellness to HRT and your sex drive. Lorraine and I are here to help you have a stylish second act and answer all your midlife questions on fashion, beauty, careers, relationships, family, and as always, the challenges and joys of parenting teens.
In today's episode, we're going to be winning at midlife with lessons from a life coach on the ground rules we should be setting for a happy now, as well as laying the foundations for a brilliant future. And Trish and I will also be chatting about confidence in midlife and the art of not giving a stuff, which, as you know, Trish, I've not really done for most
of my
life.
You've never done it. I've given quite a few stuffs, but we'll be talking about it in general, yes. Right, our main interview today is a little bit different, but Lorraine and I thought this was a really important topic to discuss because it's something we are all going to have to deal with at some times in our lives, and it will likely challenge us in ways we never knew possible. Joining us to talk about bereavement during National Grief Awareness Week is former actress Linda Magistris, founder of the Good Grief Trust.
Yes, Linda's going to be telling us about her love story and losing her partner, Graham, in midlife and how that changed the course of her future. You need to get the tissues ready. Trish and I have already got ours because we know Linda's going to be sharing some of the most important advice any of us are ever likely to hear.
Lorraine, it's jibber jabber time and I want to know your thoughts on confidence in midlife. What's boosted yours? What knocks it? And do you agree that if ever there was a time to not give a stuff, now is the time to do it?
It is true, isn't it? That's the thing. And in fact, Trini Woodall said it in our very first podcast of series three. She said she really doesn't give a shit. She's 56 and she doesn't. And this is the time to have that attitude. So there is a bit of an unraveling when you come to midlife, but that's physical. So you can sort that out, most of it out. And then there's a massive liberation, isn't there? Confidence coming to you. And I think sometimes it's mistaken as arrogance, but it isn't. It's confidence, isn't it? And you start to prune your friends, you start to accept who you are, you start to realize that you're not just a parent, that you've got other jobs and other things that you can do. You're not just in your career, or you can have a new start. I think it makes it better for family relationships. I've learned to say no a bit more to things. I've learned not to be so busy in midlife, which was what used to give me confidence, but I think was probably not ideal. I think that it's not about bad behavior, but it's about really asserting yourself, isn't it? Have you asserted yourself?
Well,
Trish?
You know, I've never been assertive, Lorraine. So for me, confidence, I think it's something I've grown into, and I think you do that from childhood. And obviously I was awful as a child and a teenager. I was so shy, cripplingly shy. I just found most day-to-day situations excruciating, from making friends to talking to adults to how I looked, all of that sort of stuff. And I kind of wanted to be invisible. And I had that very much, am I good enough? Am I good enough? And I think that can really haunt you as a woman through life. But I found in my 20s and 30s that confidence came to me through, I think, the fact that I was in a happy relationship. I had a good career. I mean, I still had mortification about, you know, when you have a hangover and you think, oh God, what did I say? And,
You know, we all have that.
That kind of can be a little bit of a dent. Then I started to feel really comfortable in my own skin by the time you hit your 40s. And then, of course, perimenopause strikes and you start doubting yourself again and you start questioning things and you're not happy and you don't know what's going on. And I think that's where, you know, the little seeds of self-doubt can be sown. And then if you don't kind of check them, they can kind of grow into these bigger things. But then, as you say, by the time you get to your 50s, hopefully you've come out the other side and you are in the official, I don't give a stuff phase of life.
Yes. I mean, we talked about this, Trish, before I hit 50, I was a bit doom, a bit Eeyore.
Yeah.
It's not like me. I'm normally quite positive. But when I turned 50, it did change. I really was much more confident. I think there's a kind of pep talk, isn't there, that you can give yourself probably midway through the 40s. Mm-hmm. I used to say, it doesn't matter what people think about you. Not that it ever bothered me, but it seemed to bother everybody around me. They seem to be crippled by this fear of what people think about them. And I think a lot of women are liberated when they realise it just doesn't matter what people think about you and not everyone can like you. That's a massive liberation. I was writing the other day, actually, a piece about the difference between being popular and being liked. And often very popular people are not at all liked. So once you kind of realise that and you stop comparing yourself, that makes you more confident, I think. And there's a really brilliant blog I read, which is called Now That I Am 50. And I thought, well, that's a great sentence. Maybe you could ask yourself that and say, now that I'm 50, I will. And my mantra is, now that I'm 50, I will say no when I want to say no. You just keep adding to that sentence. I think that's quite a nice thing to do. I read a brilliant phrase the other day about being 50 and not giving a stuff. And I think it kind of applies to you and I. It's, as long as everything is exactly how I want it, I am extremely flexible. I think that sort of sums it up, isn't it? As long as it's okay, and that's how I want it to be when I'm 50. And obviously, Trish, I think sometimes some of the most confident women, people, are not actually as confident as they seem. Isn't that true?
Well, it is, exactly. Celebrity is a really interesting one, isn't it? Because you look at these women like J-Lo, your favourite.
My favourite.
Nicole Kidman, all of these amazing women who you think, wow, they've got it all sussed. And I'm just reading loads of quotes from all of these women just talking about...
Is this your daily pep talk, How to Be More Confident by Trish?
Yes,
is that what you do?
Exactly. Just interesting because these are real women. They have these kind of moments of doubt and moments of crisis and moments of thinking, people are criticising me. But can I just tell you who just aces confidence is? Serena Williams. I just think she is a total...
She's an amazing role model.
Role model in that. So can I actually read out a quote, because I really liked this one. She says,
should we print it out and stick it on our fridge?
Yes, let's do it. Right
then.
Yes. So she says, I'm black, I'm strong, I'm powerful, and I'm confident. My arms might not look like the girl over there, or my legs might not look like someone else, or my butt, or my body, or my anything. I look people in the eye and say, if you don't like it, I don't want you to like it. I'm not asking you to like it. I love it and I love me.
Woo! Brilliant.
Go, Serena.
Also, it's a bit like looking at your teenage girls, and they sometimes are so confident. I think maybe teenage and midlife is where you should be finding a similar kind of confident level. It's about change and then finding it. One of my teenagers often says, if I display a negative quote or I moan about something, she always says, who asked you? Just get on with it. And she's just so confident. She doesn't care what anyone thinks about her. It's absolutely brilliant.
I wonder where she gets that from.
Well, I don't know. No. We talked to another mum whose teenager is persistently accused of being really quiet in class at school. And she chatted to her daughter, and her daughter said, I'm not quiet because I'm not confident. I'm not quiet because I'm an introvert. I just don't have anything to say. I listen to what other people say. I decide what I think. And then I deal with that myself. I contribute if I want to contribute. And I think that's a very powerful confidence to have, isn't it? Just being an introvert when you want to be.
But it just shows the expectations of society are that we should all be out there doing it, but we don't necessarily want to.
We might be just jolly happy being who we are.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Now it's time to meet today's guest. Linda Magistris is a former actress who set up the Good Grief Trust when she didn't know how or where to turn for help following the death of her partner, Graham. On a mission to change the way the nation deals with bereavement, she is spearheading the National Grief Awareness Week. Grief can be complicated, she says, but access to support never should be. Welcome, Linda, to Postcards from Midlife.
So I think it would be good to start kind of in the beginning, because for a Generation X listener, which we all are, you are actually quite famous, aren't you? You were in the original 1970s lineup for Grange Hill, and you played Susie, didn't you? It's so relevant to your story, isn't it? So you started there, and you met Graham, your partner, who worked on the show, and that was the beginning of a love story. Do you want to talk us through Grange Hill and Graham and how it all started?
Oh, thank you. Yes, it's so lovely to be here. And to tell my story, so I was a child actor. I went to drama school. I went to Italia Conti when I was little. Loved treading the boards and singing and dancing and everything. Anyway, I ended up at Grange Hill and playing one of the leads, which was brilliant. So it was the original series of Grange Hill, 1978, I think we launched. And it was an amazing time in my life because I sort of grew up on the programme.
Tell us about your character.
Much fun. I mean, I was a bit stereotypical, really, and I was cast for who I was. I was a bit of a
head girl.
Bit of a swat.
That's right.
So I played Susie McMahon, who was basically into doing her homework, and she did a bit of judo.
Great curly hair, though. Loved the hair.
Yeah, thank you. I did have a big mop of curly sort of 70s hair at the time. And I had this really lovely character, George, who is still my friend 40-odd years after. But he played my boyfriend, Alan. So it was all about Susie and Alan having this lovely little romance. And first time she took a bra off and...
Oh, look at the face. You can remember it all.
Oh, really? Well, it was just the first time I'd ever kissed anybody. It was just crazy because I remember our amazing director, Colin Cant, saying, right, okay, you've got to kiss George. And I was like, oh, no. He's just so lovely, but I was just so nervous and I was really naive. And it was just crazy. And then I went on to do the sequel, Tucker's Luck. But I met Graham there, yeah. So Graham was this sort of hotshot young director. We were in our 15, 16-year-olds, and he was 11 years older, actually, and he was just this really dynamic, charismatic, sort of really ambitious young guy who we all thought, oh, my God, it's Graham Feaxton. And anyway, so that was it, really. We worked together, and he went off and won a BAFTA and did incredible work in the business for, like, 30 years. And I'd had two children and had a really lovely marriage, but sadly, we didn't stay together, and... Crazily, about 30 years after I'd finished Grange Hill, I was out in Wimbledon Village and suddenly I heard this voice say, Linda. And I thought, no, it can't be. And Graham had this really distinctive, very sort of incredible voice. He'd come out of his long-term relationship. I'd come out of my marriage and we were together for 8 years. We literally the following day had lunch and that was it. It was.
How old were you then?
So I was sort of early 40s. I think I was 42, something like that.
Right.
And as I say, he was 11 years older than me. I don't know. We just had this instant connection. It was just so lovely. And we just had a really lovely time for 8 years, really.
It sounds like it was meant to be. You bumped into each other and then this person came back into your life. But as you say, it was only for 8 years. Do you want to tell us what happened?
Yeah, so it was sort of in the final year before he died, actually. And he was an incredible writer. He'd been producing and directing for donkey's years, but wanted to do writing. And he'd written a couple of amazing films and scripts that were in Hollywood. But he's left-handed and his left hand started becoming numb. All up his arm for the past year. He was sort of complaining, had loads of operations, lots of investigations, and they couldn't find anything. And I just remember it so distinctly. He was in St. George's in Tooting, and he said, look, they're going to discharge me, but they're just going to do a quick scan on my shoulder, an MRI. And he'd had all these incredible operations. Anyway, he phoned me back and said, don't bother picking me up because they found something. They found a tumour. And my heart sank. And even now, I just remember his voice. And he's just, oh, it was awful. So I just drove down there and went up to the ward. And he was standing there with a consultant. And I could see by the consultant's face that it wasn't good. And I knew because my dad had died. Well, he died 20 years ago this year. But I knew that, you know, it wasn't good. So I immediately just said, can we get him to the Marsden? I just thought, right, you know, this is really serious. And I could see his face and I started crying and it was just horrible. It was horrible. But at that point, they gave him 18 months to 2 years to live and they tried to treat him, but It wasn't good. It was an aggressive cancer.
And how did you spend that time? How did you spend that last year, knowing that you only had this short period of time left together?
Yeah, well, we only literally had 5.5 months. So they diagnosed him in the March and he died in the September. And that was just full of hospital appointments, which was horrible. Mm-hmm. You know, constantly just looking at your watch, thinking, where do you have to go? You know, who do you have to talk to? And every time it was just bad news. It was just horrible. And he was an incredibly dignified, very funny, charismatic, intelligent chap who fought it every step of the way, and he didn't want to think it was terminal. He didn't want to think that he wouldn't have a future and he wouldn't write his books, and so he was in denial. So September came and we spent 10 days in the Marsden, and they were incredible. Suddenly they just said there's no point. He had only had one round of chemo, and they said there's no point. He was just too weak. Mm-hmm. He died at home. He died overnight.
And did you have any concept over that 5 month period of how you were going to deal with his death? Had you been advised on any kind of support that you might get, anyone around you, or had the people around you been advised?
No, not at all. Obviously, in hindsight, that was something that needed to have been flagged up, really. I remember having a conversation at the Marsden once with one of the nurses who said, "Are you okay?" And I just burst into tears and said no and walked out. But that was it, really. We weren't prepared in any way, shape or form. It was all to do with the practicalities, the medication, what he needed to do. But there was no mention of support whatsoever, no.
Feels like it very much lacks compassion. You said on one of your BBC interviews that you were given a leaflet about Cruise, but you didn't qualify for the support because you didn't live in the area. And during that terrible period of grief, when you're exhausted and very stressed, you then had to start trying to find some support somewhere. It just seems an extraordinary thing.
Yeah, there was a catalogue of things that actually now I think in hindsight, I thought, okay, that was, you know, for me meant to be, because even the hospice who was looking after him at home phoned me the day after he died and checked on an appointment for later in the month. They didn't even know. Yeah. The hospice didn't even know. The communication was just so lacking. So I went to the GP and bless him, you know, tried to do his best. And he gave me a leaflet. It was a safer cruise. And I went there. I had to pretend I lived with a girlfriend in Kensington because I was in Wandsworth at the time. And there was nothing. There was nothing for a month, something like 18 months or something ridiculous. And I thought, I can't wait a few hours, let alone that. So yeah, I did go to counselling, 4 sessions, just sobbed through the whole thing. And I just thought, this is not going anywhere.
What, you were offered antidepressants as well, weren't you?
Yeah, so I went back to the GP and he basically said, look, I'm sorry, there's nothing else. We can give you sleeping tablets. And I just thought, look, that's not right for me. I'm not someone who even takes medication. So it was at that point, to be honest, that I walked out and I thought, hang on. And I've said it time and time again. I went back to the hospitals where he was treated. And I said, what do you do for bereavement support? And one of them just said, look, if you'd like to start a support group, that'd be great. This is mad. There's hundreds and hundreds of people die in this hospital. At that point, I realized, because I joined a charity that I just happened to Google, I happened to accidentally find, which was a big national charity called Widowed and Young. Fantastic. People under 50, supported exactly the way that I needed to. At that point, I realized, having chatted to everybody, they lived from John O'Groats to Land's End, everywhere. There was a lack of early signposting. There was a lack of knowledge about what services were available locally, nationally, regionally. And that is exactly what I realised. And I thought, okay, this is what we need to do, bring it together.
How long did that take you?
Okay, so he died in September 2014, and we launched the charity on BBC Breakfast on September the 2nd, the day he died, 2 years later.
That's so amazing.
It took me, by the time I'd chatted and sort of met all these bereavement teams across the country and done some research and just went out and piggybacked on every single initiative there was, and I chatted to all the charities. And I thought, okay, yeah, this needs to be done. And I just got some friends and we just phoned every bereavement service across the country and we contacted everybody and we got them all together. So it's probably about 18 months, I should imagine.
And tell us how it works.
Anyone, anywhere, whoever they've lost, they literally put their postcode into the website, thegoodgrieftrust.org, and up will pop a list of services tailored for your particular loss, that whether that's a child, a partner, a sibling, a friend, if that's suicide, baby loss, epilepsy, cancer, whatever it is, wherever you are, you can find tailored support. Because traditionally, all we've done is signpost people to a couple of major charities maybe the Samaritans, and we haven't given people the choice, because when you are grieving, you need to find other people who have been through a very similar circumstance, a similar bereavement, and that is generally what you need from the day one. Yes, you might need counselling. Yes, you might need specialist help later on, more tailored help, but right from the beginning, you need to know that other people have been through something similar, and that is so well known. Julia Samuels, who is a guru amongst grief and loss, and she's the founding patron of Child Bereavement UK, she says it isn't the circumstances of the death that will predict a positive or negative outcome. It is the support they get at the time and after the death. This is the key component to anybody finding a way to rebuild their life, and that's so key.
How far did you feel you'd gone towards rebuilding your life without Graham?
Yeah, I'm way ahead of where I was, and that I know is due to the fact that I am constantly meeting people who are so inspirational, who are so full of energy and passion and compassion. Every day I speak to someone who's bereaved. Last night I had an hour and a half call with someone who lost her husband, and she was not signposted. She stood in that hospital. Nobody told her where to go when she left that hospital. She's been on her knees since COVID, grieving in isolation, and she had no idea what was out there for her. And that is what drives me forward. You know, there's nothing I could have done to help Graham. He just got this really nasty, aggressive cancer, but I can help literally hundreds of thousands of people, and the Good Grief Trust can do that because it's not difficult. It's not rocket science. We just need to bring people together. We need to share knowledge and experience.
Do you need psychological training? Or is therapy part of recovery, or in terms of grieving for somebody? Because I know meeting people is one aspect, but counselling work, did it work for you? Is that something that people who've lost someone should go through?
Well, you know, it's grief is unique. Grief is as unique as we all are. It depends on that relationship that you've had with that person. It could be this year someone's died. It could be 40 years ago. It could have happened 6 months ago. It completely depends on you as a person, what it is you need. But generally speaking, people don't need counselling. No, they don't. Because generally, it's finding a way forward. It's finding the knowledge that your grief is understood and has been recognised. Look at all these people this year who have been in desperate conditions, grieving in isolation. They haven't been able to reach out to friends and family. They haven't had their grief acknowledged. And that is so damaging. All you need from day one is for somebody to reach out, to hold your hand virtually or physically, you know, if we can ever get to that point again, and to say, look, we know this is the most painful thing you will ever go through, but there is help out there. Mm-hmm. And that is really what you need from day one.
I lost my mother coming up for 17 years ago, and I know you lost your father as well, Linda, but the recollection of the feelings and the intensity of the everything that you're feeling and the shock. And I still even kind of return to it sometimes now, like you mentioned, it could be 40 years on, and it does, it stays with you. And I think I read somewhere that you said it never goes, but you learn to live with it somehow. The loss of that person never goes, does it?
No, it doesn't. We talk about grief being love. So the love's never going to go. They are in your heart. They are in your family. You know, if you've lost your husband or your wife and your children are there, you're constantly talking about that person because they are with you all the time, whether they're physically there or not. Your mum, your dad, your cousin, your uncles, your friends, your colleagues, they were so part of your life. Why are they suddenly... Okay, they're physically not there, but of course they continue to be in your life. And that's a really healthy thing. And that's exactly what we're trying to do. And we're trying to bust that taboo, let people have that sort of permission to grieve. I mean, last year's campaign, the National Grief Awareness Week, shared messages, really key messages. Just because I'm smiling does not mean that I'm not grieving. Mm-hmm. Say their name, we're thinking about them anyway. You know, there is no one face of grief. There is no timeline for grief. All these assumptions, all these things that we think, actually, they're not true because there are no rules. There are no judgments within grief. We really do need to wake up to the fact that we are all completely individual. We will all grieve. We will all be affected by a bereavement. It's utterly normal. I thought I was going completely crazy. I used to scream to the sky, "Where on earth are you?" Because I thought one minute he's here, next minute he's in a pot on his brother-in-law's shelf. And I just thought, that is ridiculous. And we do think that. We think we are going crazy. But people who are grieving are going through completely normal emotions, and that is what we need to get out there. We don't need to medicalize it. We don't need to do that. Yes, of course, sadly, some people have very complicated grief. And as you said, you know, maybe you've had a bereavement that you've now had a second bereavement and it's come to the same place. It comes straight back to the same place. If you haven't grieved properly, if you haven't let those emotions be free, we need to talk about grief. It's like mental health. You need to just talk about it.
Is there something you could advise people who are going through it now? Just little things that they could do that would perhaps make life a bit more bearable in that kind of for the next 10 minutes?
Yeah, I think to look after yourself, if you can. I mean, we're always full of guilt and regret and that burden. Try, if you can possibly do that, to just think there is nothing you probably could have done. So many people are filled with that and riddled with that sort of guilt and burden of, oh my goodness, you know, I didn't say this, I didn't say that. Try and let that go if you can. But I think in the immediate aftermath, if you can find something to read, a video to watch, that's what we've got on the Good Grief Trust. Many people, even if they can't reach out immediately, by reading other people's stories, by connecting with other people who have been through something, through video, through articles, you're not alone. You know, you often feel so alone and isolated, particularly if it's a husband or a wife, but you're going back to your home. You're going back to that empty, empty house. You've left them at the hospital. You are so isolated. But just to reach out and know, it can really, really help in those early days.
And what about supporting children if a partner dies or a grandparent dies, a parent of children? You know, you're going to be grieving yourself and you've also got to be looking after these children and supporting them and helping them to understand grieving. Because if we as adults are finding it difficult and struggle to manage it, how on earth do we get our kids to do that?
I think the experts, we are people who've been bereaved, but we always reach out and signpost people to those experts. And generally, it's thought of to keep some sort of normality, keep that routine going. Often, school is their safe place because home has been chaotic. It could have happened at home. They might have, unfortunately and very sadly, witnessed something happening. Often by going to school with their school friends, their peers, that is a really safe environment for them. So keep that routine going. But again, there are some wonderful specialists who can help children. There's wonderful sort of arts and activities and things that you can do that children can find really gentle and helpful to them. There's some incredible resources, some wonderful books out there. So again, please do look on our website. We will signpost out the Grief Trust.
If someone has died or lost someone or lost a child, God forbid, or a friend has committed suicide or something, how do you, as someone in the environment, talk to someone who's lost somebody?
So again, our Facebook page is incredibly popular because people can connect, they can share, they can listen. And this is actually at the top of our Facebook page. And it says, if you know someone who has lost a very important person in their life and you're afraid to mention them because you think you may make them sad by reminding them that they died, you're not reminding them. They didn't forget that they died. What you're reminding them of is that you remember that they lived. And that is a great, great gift. And that is so, so key. This is another reason why we've launched the campaign. Public awareness of how to speak to someone who's grieving is so, so important. We're so awkward. We don't know what to do. We cross
the line. It's very hard, isn't it?
It's so difficult because what you do is you just think, I've lost so many friends, sadly, because you just, it's so sad. It's difficult. It's depressing. Some people feel it quite morbid. To talk about the person, please know that all they want to do is actually, generally, some people, yes, of course, it's too painful to talk about that person. But generally speaking, if you've got a friend or family member or a colleague, please just reach out to them, pick up that phone, and not just at the funeral, not just immediately, but afterwards, 2 months after, 3 months after. And you'll find some people are really angry and they don't want to talk. But some people, most people, will really appreciate, look, can I take the children out? Can I take the dog out? Can I leave you a lasagna? But just do it. Please don't ask what they need. Just offer something. I know, again, it's really difficult. And if you don't know what to say, please just say that. Say, I don't know what to say, but I know that I'm here for you. Please know that I'm here for you. Mm-hmm.
What were the kindest things people did for you? Can you remember specifics?
Yeah, just asking me out. Come on, can I have a coffee? Come on, you know, and you don't feel like it. You don't want to get dressed. You know, you don't even want to have a cup of tea or a shower or whatever it is. You just think, I can't do it. but by really close friends, just knowing you and knowing what is good for you is amazing.
And in doing this, setting up the Good Grief Trust, which is just brilliant that you've had the power and energy to do that, has it made you think about your own mortality?
Utterly, it has made me think about my own mortality, yeah. To think about my own funeral, you know, what is it I want? You know, I used to be a wedding planner for years, and I'm now thinking, okay, what is it I need? Because I don't want someone else to sort it all out. And you know that it's so important, and so important to your family to not leave them with that burden. And yeah, we do have to wake up to it. We just got to do it. It's life and
death.
Does
it make you grasp every day though? Is it true when they say, you know, you really realise what you've got and you're properly grateful for the fabulousness of life?
Completely. My patience is so much more for people who need help, but so much less for people who talk about the nonsense of life. I'm like, I just don't have time for it. You know, unless it's happened to you, it's very, very difficult. It's like putting an old head on young shoulders. You can't really put a bereaved head on someone who hasn't really had that impact personally. But I think this is what we really need to do. We do need to raise awareness and bust those taboos.
Nobody can tell you what giving birth is like until you have given birth. And nobody can tell you what the grief and the feeling of grief is like until you've really experienced it. You can't prepare for it, can you?
Yeah, exactly. You can't prepare for it. But what you can do is raise awareness of what you might be feeling and what might happen. So many people go through deep, dark thoughts. They turn to alcohol or drug abuse. Nobody really tells you that. From day one, if you're told that actually what you are feeling is normal, you are not going mad. You are not on your own feeling these things. Maybe then we deal with it in a healthier way.
And that life goes on, because if you think about it in advance, if I think about, God forbid, something happened to my children, you just think, well, I couldn't go on. That would be it. But of course you do, don't you? Yeah. You do go on, and life does go on.
Yeah. And the strength that you feel is amazing. And you talk to so many people and seen so many people who have used the pain and the heartbreak and the real terror of losing someone so close, but they've turned it around and they've gone out there, and it's like some people turn it into a superpower. You know, I spoke to many friends who said, nothing else can hurt me. Nothing else can hurt me anymore. And they sort of get this inner strength, and it does give you this resilience to go through life with a deeper meaning. And you go, do you know what? I'm going to get out there and just live my life and do as much as I possibly can to help other people, because you know it's the most awful thing.
It's Grief Awareness Week. Tell us what you've been doing and what you've achieved or hope to achieve.
Last year, the Good Grief Trust spearheaded the National Grief Awareness Week, and we brought together, oh gosh, over 150 charities at Parliament. We had a big launch with Esther Ranson, who's a brilliant supporter of ours. And it was pretty much an online campaign, and it went out, we had pop-up cafes, and it was to raise awareness of the impact of grief and loss on a national platform, because we'd never really done it. An overarching umbrella organisation had never really done a big campaign. So this year, clearly, it's needed more than ever. Most people this year have been impacted by a bereavement somewhere, friend, family member. So we are launching it again between the 2nd and the 8th of December. Every day we are trying to support a different sector of the community and raise awareness on a really big scale. Mm-hmm. It's going to be an annual campaign, but this year we know it's had so much support and so much impact.
And will people be able to access all of that after the event as well?
They will. They'll be able to see all the events on the National Grief Awareness Week on our website.org. They'll be able to look on the Good Grief Trust. They'll be able to see how and where they can get their support. And this is exactly why we've done it early Christmas, because Christmas will be so difficult for so many people. Mm. And not just Christmas, January, February, those dark, horrible months, into next year and beyond. Please do look for the support.
How do you think Graham would feel, and how would he be reacting if he knew what you had done? How do you remember him now?
I mean, I'm just very sad that he never really got to see his dreams. I mean, everyone knew how successful he was and everything, but I think he would have loved to sit on an island like Ian Fleming and write a few books.
Thank you so much, Linda. That was such a brilliant conversation, a really important conversation, and we're delighted to be spreading the word about the Good Grief Trust, and good luck with the rest of the Awareness Week.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Now it's time for our weekly What Would You Do dilemma. And the question today is a bit of an ongoing bugbear. So Lorraine, here it is. You open your teenager's bedroom door to a horror show of dirty pants, mouldy mugs, and an explosion of makeup all over the floor, possibly including the new foundation that went missing from your makeup bag last week. So do you tidy it up or do you close the door and walk away?
Well, your instinct is to tidy it up because you need a biohazard suit and some crime scene tape normally before you go in. And bearing in mind, I'm writing a book about parenting teenage girls, which I think it applies to boys as well. Every expert I have spoken to says, do not tidy it up. Do not go in. So no rescuing, no sorting, no controlling. Leave it to them. So Janie Downshire, who's a family therapist who wrote a book, Teenagers Translated, talked to me at length about this, that it is a problem for you, but it is not a problem for them. So A, they have to learn to deal with the way they live themselves, which is fine. I mean, you can take the dirty cups and stuff like that out, but their brain is undergoing a massive remodeling in teenage. So while you can see the mess, actually physically, they just can't see it. And it's responsible for loads of other things. It has a slight ripple effect. If they lose something and they can't go to school, or if they borrow something of yours and they don't give it back, they're not stealing it. They're not getting confused. Physically, their brains cannot work it out. So we have to be really, really patient with them. But also, this is their domain. And privacy, when you're building your new identity, is incredibly important to you. Anyone that interferes with that will be viewed incredibly dimly and disliked. So you really can't go in there. I think there are some practical tips, though. So you can ask them, do you choose to dry yourself with a soaking wet towel, or would you like a dry one?
Yeah.
And then you can leave them to do that, because their room often looks like it's been burgled, and then someone's taken a shower and then listened to some music and then done some art on the walls and then ground something into the carpet if possible, and then thrown all the tiny earrings they have all around the room. But actually, that's not what they're seeing. That's just what you're seeing. So the advice is shut the door and walk away.
As they get older as well, I think the dynamic changes a bit. The twins are 16, nearly 17 now. And I feel like this year has been an amazing transition. I don't know whether it's just all because we've been locked at home together for so long, but also they've gone to sixth form college. Neil and I feel like we're house sharing. It's sort of almost like not parenting as much anymore. We're house sharing with these two really lovely young adults. So we're not having rows. We're not doing any of that. It's just really lovely. It feels very like they've grown up enormously. But oh my God, the bedrooms. They are still.
Yeah. And there must be rules around communal space, I think.
Well, totally.
We've got a 9-year-old. It's not fair for her to come down to stuff.
No, exactly. It is like the muddy trainers left in the hall drives me nuts and the sliders left in the sitting room and all of that kind of thing. But at least it's sort of not too dirty. The bedrooms, I'm just like, you know what, I'm kind of following that advice.
Oddly, my 18-year-old who's left home now and is at university, her bedroom from the Zoom calls, because I often ask for a little tour, is so tidy.
Her bedroom, interesting.
Before this, I wouldn't have gone in without a tetanus injection. I didn't like the dog to go in case she ate something terrible and had to be taken to the vet to have her stomach pumped. So it's kind of... and it is really tidy. She's very organised.
Yes.
If you're tidy around them, all behaviour is communication for teenagers. Everything they are seeing, they are absorbing. So, you know, I'm quite tidy, but a bit mucky. You're very tidy and very clean.
Oh, God, super tidy. Yeah, super tidy, super organised. But you know who loves the messy bedrooms?
Dogs and cats.
Margot
would love it, wouldn't she?
Margot loves it. She's up there in the dirty washing, wrapped up in the bed with all this like blankets and jackets, and that's where she goes. Quite nice.
She likes it, Trish, because she hates it.
Yeah, exactly. She just
because she's your opposing spirit animal. She's your contrary cat, as I call her. But Trish, how was your bedroom when you were a teenager? What was that, 1980s?
Well, it definitely was the sanctuary and it was my space. But I had to share with my sister for a very long time. And I think I got my own bedroom when I was about 14. So you can imagine it was such a big deal. It was so tidy because I was so proud of having this room. And also my parents, my poor mum, she would have gone mental if we'd have left our rooms in the state that our kids' rooms were in. But it was a different time, a different generation, a different way of doing things.
Maybe, I don't know. I was quite messy at home. Yeah. I mean, I did share as well for a bit, and I grew up in a very small bungalow, so each of the rooms were quite tiny. But my sister was very messy as well. Looking back, I just don't think we had as much stuff.
No, we didn't.
As they had. Yeah. So it was kind of different. It was difficult to make it messy when you didn't have many things. You know, that's the issue, isn't it? I think really the answer to the what would you do dilemma is just let them be, leave them alone. Now, Trish, we're at How to Win at Midlife. So you like to indulge in a little bit of life coaching, don't you? And you certainly help me focus with a few things with your life coaching. So tell us how that can help us win at midlife.
Yes, you know me, Lorraine. I am a big fan of coaching and I've trained to be a coach. And I just think life coaching is a really valuable way to take stock of where you are in your life, what your expectations are you likely to meet them, as well as identifying the choices you have. Because quite often I think we don't look at what choices we can have and make in life. So it's a good way to kind of take stock of that and look at what direction your life is going in. So I've been talking to life coach Judy Reith, who, along with her husband Adrian, has written this really helpful book called Act 3, The Art of Getting Older, which is about getting set for that third stage of life, which we used to call retirement, which is roughly 50 onwards.
Oh, don't say that.
Really, if you think about it, probably friends, family, you're kind of moving towards it. You're moving towards it. We're seeing it coming. But for our generation, as we know, we are Generation X, we've got this incredible opportunity to live a really enjoyable, longer life and in really good health if we choose to see it that way. So we'll probably have a very different experience to our parents' generation.
Sounds a bit ominous, Trish, to me, life coaching. Can I be life coached into being an astronaut, maybe?
Yes, of course you can.
Can
you can do anything.
Winning an Olympic medal in my
60s. You can
60s.
Do fantasy astronauting. How about that? You can coach someone.
I can't be weightless, Trish. That'll never happen.
Really, it's about living more of the life that is true to who you are. So first off, that means working out a few things about yourself. And Judy has very handily created a visual analogy of a tree where there are four roots representing your attitude, your purpose, your values, and your key relationships. And in the book, there are lots of like really inspiring case studies that illustrate this. But to give you an idea, I will run through them briefly. No eye rolling from you.
I'm not going to eye roll, but I'm very anti this kind of structured lack of spontaneity.
Oh, no, I love it. Right, let me start with attitudes. So if you think about it, attitudes, this is the one thing in your life that you have total control over, of how you choose to see things or respond to things, because we can all choose the decisions that we make, right, and how we do it. And the question Judy suggests you ask yourself when making a decision, does it help or is it going to hurt? So have a think about that.
That's interesting. Is it
making,
does it help or is it going to hurt?
Don't focus on the hurt. Purpose, next. So this is about your reason for getting up in the morning, other than obviously getting the kids out the door to school. It's kind of thinking...
That's my reason for getting up in the morning.
At the moment, yeah, just breakfast. Get them out the door. Get them out. But it's thinking about what you love to do and where you do things like you don't notice time passing. Talking to me on this podcast, Lorraine. Not really. But it's kind of, what kind of did you want to do when you were a child? What did you love doing? And she says not to worry if it doesn't come to you quickly, because it will come to you in the end. And it's all about this idea of this person inside waiting to come out.
Yeah, I see. I listened to a podcast with Oprah and Brené Brown the other day, and they had set one of their listeners a task to go back to her childhood home, look through all the photos. She was lost in her life. She didn't know what to do next. Look through all her childhood photos and see the common themes. And she'd forgotten. She'd forgotten that she used to play musical instruments a lot as a child. And she loved it. She'd never been made to do it, as her parents hadn't made her do it. It wasn't a dreary practicing. And she came back to it in her 40s after a divorce. And she said it was the one thing that made her happy. And if she hadn't gone back to thinking about being a child and looked through that and talked to her parents, she wouldn't have realised what was missing.
And another good way is to ask people who care about you, the, you know, your parents, your family, your friends, what you're good at and what kind of lights you up. What do they see in you that's a skill or a talent or a passion? So that's a kind of a way of kind of getting to this point of purpose. The third root of this imaginary tree is values.
And values.
Values are good. And this is the time in life to prioritize your values, because quite often we've probably grown up and been living with maybe other people's values and thinking about the phrases, oh, I should do this, I ought to do this, or I must do this. And those are words we shouldn't be using at this time in life. We should be doing things because we want to do them, not because we should do them or ought to do them or must do them. So again, if someone else was describing your qualities, ask them, maybe come up with three and kind of just kind of keep them nearby and see if you are genuinely
your three
living
qualities,
those.
Trish.
kindness is really important to me. Yeah, really important to me. And trying to see the wow in other people and getting them to see the wow, if that makes sense, and just drawing it out of them, which I, you know, is really important to me. And just, I think being aware of what's going on in the world and knowing that I have a role to play and responsibilities in terms of the environment or that kind of thing. So doing my bit, I suppose, in terms of the wider community in the world. What about you?
Well, I think I'd like someone to say kind. She was kind. I think I'd like someone to say she was jolly optimistic and positive and upbeat and funny. And I think maybe also smart. That's one of my values, always to try and make the smart decision. Yeah.
So whether or not
it's the thing you want to do or other people are doing and not be influenced, just to be smart about what is good for you and your kind of family. Well, I like this.
This is going well. 4-3 is key relationships. And this is the kind of cocktail of all the important people in your life. Again, partners, friends, kids and parents. And Judy says that they really matter more. We might not be thinking about this, but they really do matter more and more as we get older, because we're going to start to lose people and our lives might become a bit smaller. We know there's an epidemic of loneliness out there, especially this year for people. Yes. So it's like, you know, you might think you're just happy there at home with your cat or your dog, but actually, you know, you need to spend time nurturing those relationships. And she had a really good suggestion for your main relationship, if you have a partner, is to have an annual MOT. You don't do it at home. You maybe go out for the day or you go away somewhere overnight.
Oh, and Mr. Candy would resist this. He would call it navel gazing.
There's nothing wrong with that. That's what we need. This is the whole point. We need to do a bit of navel gazing. Apparently, you're supposed to each come up with an agenda. And
I do it with Neil.
You could do it with James. Yeah, exactly. You have to then go away and kind of almost you discuss these things that are important to you.
What things? What do you say?
It can be you want to tell your partner what you appreciate about them, and then you tell them, and you have to be very, very specific. I think with men in particular, you really need to tell them. It's not good enough to say, I really could do with some more help around the house, or I could really do with, you know, some more help with the kids. It would be really great if you could pick the kids up on a Sunday afternoon or whatever it is, or from school on a Monday, and you just ask them to do one or two things that is going to make your life better. And then you appreciate the things that they are doing for you. So, God, I really love it when you bring me a cup of tea when I've got a hangover. So it's that kind of thing. So it all sounds a bit obvious, and I know you might think it's a bit woo-woo.
People don't do it though, do they? People don't communicate. It's really about communicating, isn't it?
Exactly. Or it might be that you think it's time to write a letter to my mum, or I want to take she wouldn't like that. Okay. There we are. So that's kind of the roots. And then holding up the tree. Imagine visualizing this tree is your health.
She's just being a tree now. Look, she's literally being a tree trunk.
And that's about taking care of ourselves, because obviously the aging process is going to do what it does to us, and we need to be taking care of ourselves. And then from there, we have the branches of the tree. And that's quite a lot of different things, like the day-to-day things of life, like work, money, that sort of thing. And the book works through all of those things, and I just found it super helpful. And you know what, I think it's the perfect time of year to do this, because new year, aren't we? We're heading into another year that we all hope and pray is going to be a much better one than this has been. So I think it's quite a good time to take stock.
I think that's very helpful, very well explained, Trish. So this book is called Act 3, The Art of Getting Older by Judy and Adrian Reese, and I believe there's some videos, aren't there, that go with it, which is on their act3life.com website. So check those out, and then let us know how you got on in the Facebook group, because it'd be interesting to know. This is about taking a moment, isn't it, stepping back and talking about what's going to happen next, which is a very good idea.
And in fact, we will be actually having a book to give away on the Facebook group as a prize. So do head on to there and you can enter that competition.
Right, Trish, we are ready for your nostalgia noodling. What have you discovered back in the time vault?
In the day. Well, see, we've already had a little trip to Grange Hill, which has been
excited about that.
Rather lovely.
Can you remember? It was so brilliant, Grange Hill,
really
wasn't it?
It really was.
Brilliant.
And I always remember Tricia Yates. She was the one I remember, because obviously I'm Trish, so I was... she was tall and skinny, which I definitely wasn't. But anyway...
Krusky.
I was also in a bit of a TV mode. Well, a sort of sporty TV mode, because
that's
I realised
that... not like
that
you.
I don't know anything about sport these days.
No.
Back in the 70s, I knew everything there was to know about sport. Can I just throw a few names at you?
What? How did you know?
Ray Reardon.
No, don't understand. Who's he?
Kevin Keegan.
Who's that snooker player? Steve somebody.
Yeah, exactly. This is what I'm talking about. I knew all the sports. And do you know why? Because that's what we had to watch. Because my dad loves sport. And
Oh, you only had one telly.
The one telly. Usually a big sort of brown box in the corner of the living room. And, you know, my dear old dad had been at work all day, working very, very hard. So he obviously got to choose what to watch in the evening or on a Saturday afternoon. And it was always the sport. So we were either like, well, you either watch it or you don't. Kind of thing. So golf.
Can you imagine saying to your teenagers now, this is it, you've got to watch it?
Yeah. Well, the thing that brought it up was I saw a clip of Question of Sport and I literally not a clue. But back in the day, it was my favourite programme. I used to answer all the questions. Quite the sporting buff.
Did you have a football team?
I did. Tottenham Hotspur.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
Now, do you know where I've been?
Where have you been?
Well, my son just turned 14. And he wanted a new Rubik's Cube. I mean, we've got like thousands of them, broken bits of them in the house. And I thought, that's ridiculous, a Rubik's Cube. And then that took me back to birthdays.
Yes.
In the 70s and 80s. Do you remember birthdays?
Yes, I did. I do.
Jelly and ice cream.
Yes, jelly and ice cream.
Can you imagine if you served jelly and ice cream now? They'd go, why is that with that? That's ridiculous. Pass the parcel in a community centre. Can't have that now, can you? Nobody's got a newspaper. You can't wrap anything up. There's no actual paper in the house. It's all online, isn't it? I was just thinking how poorly catered they were, but also how low-key. And that was still considered...
I'm just going to say very well catered, because it was it was little sandwiches, fairy cakes, jelly and ice cream. I mean, that's got to be better than a kind of a fast food takeaway box with some bits of plastic in it or whatever it is that you give them.
There's a wonderful picture. There's a website called Historical Pictures that just occasionally throws up a 70s, 80s picture. And there's a brilliant picture which made it into all the newspapers of a little boy. He must be about three, blowing the candle out on his cake. Mm-hmm. And as he's blowing the candle out, there's two people in the background smoking cigarettes, which are literally being waved about three centimetres from his face. Yeah. There's crushed beer cans and unemptied ashtrays, and granny sat opposite him clapping, and you just think that would never never happen.
Those were the days. That's all I can say.
So that little nostalgia noodle brings us to the end of this episode of Postcards from Midlife. Thank you very much for listening. If you enjoyed it, please tell your friends and all the midwife women you know. And remember to subscribe on your podcast provider, and please rate and review us too.
And don't forget to join us on our Facebook group, on Instagram, or you can email us at hello@postcardsfrommidlife.com. Goodbye.
Goodbye.